are tuned to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno. It's 8 a.m. Stay tuned for special programming for this International Women's Day.
I'm Kit Raphael, your host for this hour. If you'd like to see what's coming up today in this special International Women's Day coverage, you can go to our blog, kbfawomensmag.blogspot.com. Well, if all that talk about Fukushima has you depressed, this next segment will cheer you up. The environmental movement has historically been a bastion of white men, but the women of movement generation are shaking things up. Stay with us.
Have I been sleeping?
Women around the Bay are observing International Women's Day in lots of different ways, but one of the most innovative is happening right now in San Francisco's Mission District. It's a rainwater harvesting workshop with a women-led organization of gray water technicians. And it's organized by PODER, people organized to demand environmental and economic rights, along with Movement Generation, a new type of environmental justice project. I recently sat down with three of the women who are shaping Movement Generation and its unique blend of liberation permaculture, resilience-based organizing, strategic planning, and in-depth analysis to address the climate crisis and its disproportionate impact on communities of color. Carla Perez is a mother and community organizer of Native and Latin American heritage living in Oakland. She has a BS in Conservation and Resource Studies from UC Berkeley. She's worked on issues of environmental justice and sustainable agriculture with community groups from Yucatan, Mexico, to Bay Area environmental justice communities such as Richmond and Bayview Hunters Point. Doria Robinson is a third-generation resident of Richmond, California, and the executive director of Urban Tilth, a community-based organization rooted in Richmond dedicated to cultivating a more sustainable, healthy, and just food system. Doria received a Human Rights Award from the City of Richmond for her work in environmental education in 2013. Ellen Choi grew up in the L.A. area as the daughter and granddaughter of Chinese and Korean immigrants. Since graduating from UC Berkeley in 2007, she's been working to uplift and support the leadership of low-income communities of color in the fight to address climate change and build sustainable alternatives. She's an active member of HOBAC, Hella Organized Bay Area Koreans, and a hip-hop soul-funk DJ. And she's a community radio producer on KPFA's Apex Express, so you'll probably recognize her voice.
Why don't we start with how you each got involved in environmental justice work? It's clear that y'all have deep roots in land-based activism and culture, but, you know, a lot of people in your cohort who might come from similar backgrounds have made different choices about where to focus police brutality or economic justice. So I'm curious how you each came to devote your life to environmental justice and climate justice. Carla, do you want to start?
I really came into the social justice movement, into working for the liberation of oppressed people through the environmental justice movement. And that passion got sparked by wanting to work with communities of my own lineage and heritage, which, you know, is the Mexican and Central American community, and really looking at the farm workers' struggle. And then also just wanting to, you know, fight for the liberation of Mother Earth, you know, having a really close spiritual and cultural connection to the land. Also, I really studied the history of where capitalism and colonization really seeded oppression and destructive systemic relationships here in the Americas and in other places, and really saw the disintegration of peoples from the land, the place that they were evolved to be in, as like the first major, you know, act that from there caused the domino effect of environmental and ecological degradation, peoples forced to give or sell their labor, and all the different environmental and social injustices that we face today. So that same root cause, you know, at a different scale and in a much more industrialized and global way today, the same root cause is what's has brought climate chaos to our planet.
Doria Robinson.
I was just trying to figure out how to draw a map of how I arrived where I'm at
I think it really started having my foot in two worlds, really. Growing up in Richmond, in the Iron Triangle, where everything was kind of pavement and closed and you had to protect yourself. But having a really long leash, being outside all the time, like riding my bike. And then having that kind of juxtaposed with going away to camp. I went to Camp Mendocino every year. It's like this boys club camp in the Redwoods. And there, you know, I just developed this intense passion for hiking and for nature trail. And there was a guy, Jose, that ran nature trail, and he just turned you on to learning about birds and all this kind of stuff. And it was like these two extremely different realities. And they didn't make sense. You know, in Richmond, you know, everything was very tunnel vision. And I couldn't name anything, you know. I couldn't name the mountains around me. And then when I was out in the forest, in the Redwoods, you know, the whole point was to get in relationship, to learn more, to name, to have a serious connection and a knowledge and a sense of awe and responsibility for that space. I spent a lot of time growing up with my grandmothers as well. I had both of my grandmothers and both of my great-grandmothers growing up, and all of them gardened. And that, I think that was the one place where I realized you could have a relationship with Earth, even in an industrial city. You could grow food. And soil was soil was soil was soil. And I had the opportunity after college to actually come home and work in Richmond. And, you know, it was just kind of a shocking moment where I stand in the space that I spent so much time in thinking, you know, when I was a kid, that I was really alert and alive and knew what was going on, and realized that I had been staring at Mount Tamalpais my whole life and didn't know it from my bedroom window. And at this point, I could ask the question, well, why is that? How come I never learned the name of that mountain? And how come no one ever said anything about the factory, you know, the refinery that was in front of the mountain? And how come, you know, I'd never been to Brooks Island? And how come I'm not the only one? More and more the answers ended up with Chevron, company control of the city, and, you know, just all of the economic injustices that come with living in a low income city of people of color, how that plays out in the education system, how that plays out environmentally, how that plays out on our health. More and more, I just realized that my work was not only in Richmond, but it was in environmental justice, and environmental justice was basically the root that connected, you know, all of my passions and all the people I loved.
And Ellen Choi.
When I was young, I had some kind of innate allergy to mainstream culture. I don't know where it came from, but I knew that there was something about the culture of, you know, other people in my schools and stuff like that I just didn't relate to. So I don't know, maybe that's where it started. And I grew up in the LA, greater LA area. And then I moved up here to go to Berkeley. And it was there that I started reading and hearing things that put words to kind of my heart feeling. At the same time, I found hip-hop, really. Like, I kind of knew hip-hop in high school, but I really found it, the hip-hop and also the spoken word community. And at that time, the spoken word community was just an extension of the hip-hop community. And I think that was actually one of the biggest moments of politicization for me, because I was hearing things in songs and also written in poems that was calling out exactly what that allergy was in me. And then I started taking classes and learning about the resource wars that were going on in the world, and learning about the e-waste trade in China, I remember, was one big eye-opener to me, because having family still in China, I was like, oh, like, this is actually a global phenomenon, and I'm already in the belly of the beast right now, so I have a responsibility to do something. I graduated college, and something in the universe got me my first job at the Environmental Justice and Climate Change Initiative, which was a national coalition connecting EJ organizations. And I remember it was like the first weekend on the job, they flew me out to Atlanta for this meeting of the steering committee, and I found myself at the table of all of my, like, movement heroes. It was like Robert Bullard and Tom Goldtooth and all these people who I've been working since the beginning of the environmental justice movement and defining that term, hearing people's stories and meeting people who are doing amazing work on the ground, rooted in their community, tied to who they are, their identity, their families. Like, I really saw the importance of on-the-ground organizing and base building and the grassroots movements. Finding MG was a huge part of my political development. People who blew open the term for me, environmental justice, and it wasn't just about, you know, protecting ourselves in the concrete jungle, but it was actually like taking that concrete up and finding our roots and our connection to land and to resources and what that all means. So,
and tell me about Movement Generation. What is it and how did it get started?
Movement Generation is a really special and beautiful thing in the world. We are a collective of organizers who come from various backgrounds in liberatory organizing work. We came together around an analysis that we all shared in common, that we were operating separately with until we found each other and realized that we all really felt sort of the political left social justice movement was not taking into account enough the impact of the ecological crises on the same communities that we organize with for housing and for transit justice and around immigrant rights and women's rights and youth leadership and environmental racism and labor exploitation and, you know, being locked out of the economy and like all those things. It was not strongly factored in as part of the analysis of the problem, and was also not being factored in enough as part of the solutions that we were looking for as a movement to transform and transcend the state that our people are in. I mean, that's not to say at all that it wasn't out there, you know, that people weren't making connections. Of course, people were making the connections, but it wasn't, it somehow it hadn't gelled. We all had a, you know, real similar analysis of the past and the present and the future and what needed to go forward, or how the movement could go forward in a more holistic and unified way, and wanting to foster spaces for movement leaders to make that more and more a part of their work with communities that they're working with.
So Movement Generation is the group organized, open to, or primarily interested in organizing people of certain age groups?
We very much see ourselves as a family project. Ellen, being the most recent addition to the core collective, is the first person who didn't have children. You know, before that, all of us have, you know, kids, and we're all very like, but you know, we all have partners and family obligations, and you know, Ellen's like auntie to everybody else's children, and we all have a relationship to each other's families.
Well, that actually brings up something I wanted to ask about, because it's commonly believed in the movement that having children is so much work and is really the foremost demand on people's emotional energy as well as their physical energy, that it's not realistic to expect people with kids, certainly young kids, to be very involved in movements. You know, and I've always, when I've heard that, I've always thought, well, if you look at the history, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the farm workers movement, I mean, you know, that's just not really realistic. But I've always kind of heard it, and even within the feminist movement, and you know, now you have people like Sheryl Sandberg writing books like Lean In, and you know, people talking about why can't women have it all. But you all, as you say, most of you are parents and you are doing political work, you are dedicating your life to that work. So I guess I want to ask, one, what are the challenges of that? And two, what are the structures and processes that you use to overcome those challenges? Doria? Yeah.
First off, you have to acknowledge that it is seriously challenging to be the mom, the dad that you want to be, and basically have another child, which is your role in the movement and your responsibilities to the movement. But also, I think that I don't think that I would be speaking just alone to say that my being a mother completely informs and drives the work that I do and deepens my commitment to doing this work, because I think it's just imperative that we, you know, shift the direction that culture that this planet is moving in, if there's going to be a next generation or a seven generation, you know, having my kids, I have twins, 11-year-old twins, as a constant reminder of that responsibility, you know, wanting them to, you know, be able to choose to have kids and bring their kids into a world that's inhabitable, that has opportunities for wonder and connection that we have. It makes me really creative when I'm working. My workday begins at 3 a.m. because that's when I can get a bunch of things work, you know, done before I have to get my kids up at 6. You know, I have to struggle with things like, you know, well, when isn't a work day? And my kids asking me that, you know. But then I think about, you know, okay, we can think about work and life and act like they're separate things. But this is the life that I'm living. This is what I've chosen to do. And I don't really want a vacation from my life.
For Movement Generation, being a family-based organization is also part of the way that we resist, you know, what the corporate dominant lifestyle and set of values has led people in this country to do, you know, and that is to disintegrate from our families in order to do the things that we need to do. And we outright believe that that's wrong, you know, that it's unhealthy, that it's unnatural. Culturally, we all come from backgrounds where, and from countries, honestly, even like within Movement Generation and, you know, the Black Liberation Movement here in the U.S. and the Chicano Liberation Movement here in the U.S., the Native American Resistance. I mean, these are family-based struggles where kids are at the meetings and kids are at the marches. You know, that's how they learn. That's how they build camaraderie. That's where their value sets are born. And that's where they find, you know, holistic love and learn to see their lives and being dedicated to improving the world and themselves and their communities as a way of life, not as a job. You know, we've been forced to professionalize the most dignified work here in the United States. It's become about building organizations rather than building a movement. Ask anybody how many times they had to choose between building their, you know, doing something that was going to build their organization's name over doing something that was actually going to be more beneficial for the movement they were trying to spark.
This is Special International Women's Day programming here on KPFA. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm speaking with Doria Robinson, Ellen Choi, and Carla Perez, all core members of the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project.
You've developed something called resilience-based organizing. Ellen, can you tell us what that is?
Resilience-based organizing is actually applying our own labor to meet the needs of our community that aren't being met otherwise, whether it's a government entity who's not turning on your water because you can't pay your bill, or it's a corporate entity who's controlling the way, you know, your clean air, for example, or the way you get your food. We're meeting our needs by applying our own labor, but at the same time, we're also looking to contest for power and actually butt up against the laws or the entities that are denying us that right to that need. We've been co-sort of developing this idea with partners like Urban Tilth and Poder in San Francisco, which we saw as organizations who are already exemplifying this model and who also we love and respect a lot. And so we got together and started talking about, like, naming these things in the landscape of social movements in the U.S., naming our historical examples and the things that aren't that's needed and this model, and then actually developing it, going on learning exchanges around the country to learn from other organizations. Really amazing manifestation of many elements of resilience-based organizing is the Occupy the Farm project that took off in Albany right after sort of the big culmination of Occupy. They took over land in Albany in the East Bay that was some of the last agricultural grade soil in the entire East Bay. It was land owned by the University of California, and I know KPFA has covered Occupy the Farm a lot. You know, this place is owned by the university, quote unquote, public land, but really just controlled by the university, which is also controlled by so many corporations. This land was being used for genetic research, and a group of people got together, broke the locks, plowed the soil and then replanted fresh fruits and vegetables. We saw this as resilience-based organizing because it was it identified that this is agricultural-grade soil and farmland is for farming. And there's so many people in the Bay Area without fresh fruits and vegetables living in food deserts. So we're going to apply our own labor, literally putting our work, our sweat into the soil to build up a farm. And they did that, and they held this land for 2-3 weeks.
So, Daria, Ellen mentioned Urban Tilth, one of the partner organizations with Movement Generation, and you're the director of that organization. Tell us about it.
So Urban Tilth is a Richmond-based nonprofit completely run by Richmond residents. So every member of the staff live in Richmond or San Pablo, I should say. We operate 13 different school and community gardens around Richmond. We are in the process of developing a 3-acre farm in North Richmond and a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Project, to bring affordable organic food to people in Richmond, because we have very few grocery stores, especially ones that offer fresh, healthy produce. The magic of Urban Tilth doesn't happen in that description. The magic of Urban Tilth is realizing that Urban Tilth, I always talk about Urban Tilth as a vehicle, like something that, you know, kids from the community get into and they learn to drive, you know, and they learn to move themselves from one place in their life to another place in their life. And along the way, they're picking up skills and experience and stopping at different locations, and more people are getting on, like on the bus, on the Urban Tilth bus. We have 15 staff that are year-round, and we blow up to 60 in the summer. You have a summer youth apprentice program. It's a paid work experience program. Almost 80% of our staff has come to us through the summer apprentice program. So they're former youth that we used to work with either at our program at Richmond High School. We have a urban agriculture and American food systems class that we teach in collaboration with the West Contra Costa Unified School District. It meets every day, operates a garden, a farm, and a CSA, and now a nursery where they're doing plant sales. So these former students are now actually running the organization and defining the work of the organization and going through pretty deep processes with, you know, Movement Generation trainings, with other professional development trainings, to really not just learn how to grow food, but to grow themselves, ourselves. like I said before, I was born and raised in Richmond, third generation. I was actually sitting today with one of our newest employees. He just finished the summer apprentice program this last summer and came on with one of our oldest employees, Bienvenida Mesa. She is an amazing woman who runs the Verde Garden at Verde Elementary School in North Richmond. Been there for 20 years, the oldest garden in Richmond. So he was working under Ms. Mesa, and he was like, you know, I grew up in Richmond, in North Richmond, all my life, but I've never experienced Richmond the way I experience it through Urban Tilth.
One of the things I heard about that made me want to know more about Movement Generation was a women's healing clinic last November at the Humanist Hall in Oakland, not far from where I live. Why did you see the need for a women's healing clinic, and what was that like?
The Women's Healing Clinic 2013 was a beautiful and important vision that I had been having for a few years when I witnessed something similar in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I knew that women here in the Bay Area needed such a space. It's very much part of the shared vision that we have at Movement Generation, is, again, the understanding of how much wealth and knowledge and wisdom and healing and instructions for a good way of life are found in ancestral connections. And knowing that healing is a huge missing factor in a lot of the social change work that we do. You know, that all of us come from traumatized communities. You know, we have a historic experience that is ongoing in the present day, you know, of communities being oppressed, marginalized, neglected, or abused, that has left a generational scar that gets deeper, you know, every time that we pass those things on to the next generation without doing deep healing work. And that going to the medical industrial complex, which is run by the same organizations, which has the similar capitalist mission, which is isolating and disjunctive, which compartmentalizes our symptoms rather than looking at us as an integrated person and looking at the root causes, the multiple and layered root causes of health conditions that we experience today, is actually in some cases making people worse. You know, physically worse, mentally and psychologically worse, spiritually worse. And that's even if you have access to that complex. So the Women's Healing Clinic was really about planting the seed of returning to the sacred, of reconnecting and reestablishing reverence and respect for the ways of healing and self-care that our ancestors employed for thousands of years before we were introduced to the kinds of things that make us so sick that we would have to turn to pharmaceutical medicine, right, to cure us. It had to be free. It had to be first come, first serve. And Movement Generation, again, because it's a political project, stepped up to be the fiscal and administrative sponsor for the Healing Clinic Collective, which is the group, including myself, that organized the clinic. And, you know, lends the analysis that politicizes that sacred work and offers loving, holistic, healing, traditional modalities of therapy and self-care and nourishment and healing to the most vulnerable populations of women in the Bay Area. It was a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful thing. It was like a parallel universe in that space for 2 days. We served almost 400 women with 18 different healing or therapeutic non-industrial practices. And we are still receiving inquiries today. The clinic was November 7th and 8th of 2013. And I continue to receive emails asking when the next clinic is taking place and how people can help and volunteer and contribute. And so this year we will be having two smaller one-day healing clinics that are neighborhood-based in collaboration with grassroots with a small g, you know, organizers or organizations in those two areas. We're looking at Deep East Oakland and Richmond. And the Healing Clinic Collective is also going to move forward with organizing a full two-day men's healing clinic this year, similar to the women's healing clinic that took place last year.
Carla Perez and Ellen Choi are staff members and core collective members of the Movement Generation Justice and Ecology Project. Doria Robinson is executive director of Urban Tilth and a member of the Movement Generation Planning Committee. I spoke with them at their offices in West Berkeley to find out about their upcoming women's healing clinics, storytelling workshops, earth skills trainings, or their many other incredible programs. Visit their website, movementgeneration.org. The music we heard at the beginning was by Melissa Etheridge. We began with history and we'll end with a little history too. Here's a tribute to one of the unsung heroes of our past, Lucy Parsons.
Lucy Ella Gonzalez Parsons was born in 1853 of Mexican, African, and Native American descent.